Greetings, everyone. This is Jonathan Alexander. I'm editor of College Composition and Communication. And today we are here with Laurie Grobman, whose piece, Disturbing Public Memory and Community Writing Partnerships, appears in the September issue, 2017. With me also is editorial assistant, Jens Lloyd. Laurie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
No, not at all. This is a really interesting piece, I have to admit. As somebody who's worked with community partnerships in the past, I was really intrigued to hear how you would talk about what does it mean, what are some of the complexities of working with community partners. And yours is interesting in that it talks about some heady emotions that people were facing. And so tell us a little bit about how you came to this research and what you discovered.
Okay, so I came to the research through the project that joined several classes of students, some that I taught, some that others taught, although I was the coordinator of the project because I run our small service learning and community-based research program here at Penn State Berks. So what happened was... I've been involved with student and community partnerships where students write local histories. So we've worked with, we've created or produced African American local histories, Jewish local histories, Hispanic Latino local histories over the past decade or more now. So with this project, I had just become a member of the board of directors of the Olivet Boys and Girls Club. We refer to it as the Olivet, so I hope that's okay. It was founded in 1898, and it got the name Olivet because at one point in the early 1900s, it was located in a church, an Olivet Presbyterian church. But it was one of the original 50 boys clubs organizations that joined together in Boston in 1905 to become the Federated Boys Clubs, which now today is Boys and Girls Clubs of America. So it just had this amazing history. So when I joined the board, I don't remember exactly the chronology, but someone suggested that knowing the work I had done before with students, that we enlist students in my courses and other courses to write the history of this, you know, more than 100-year-old boys, now Boys and Girls Club.
Got it.
So the way this particular research project came about was that, you know, there was a lot of work, there was a lot of organization before students started the work. Mm-hmm. But mainly the work, the research was just, I mean, I call it an archive, but it was, I guess, what's called an informal archive. They had just, they meaning various people throughout 115 or so years had saved documents of all different kinds, newsletters, photographs, flyers, newspaper articles. And there was, if I remember correctly now, that the founder of this Boys and Girls Club of the Olivet was, his name was William McCormick, and he also owned the newspaper, the local newspaper. So they had a lot of access, even in 1898, to print, to being able to print documents. And I had gone into the project through both the perspective of narrative history as well as public memory. I had only just started working on a book, an edited collection with Jane Greer from UMKC called Pedagogies of Public Memory. And so what I was expecting was was that the students would help to uncover stories of the children and their families who were working boys. The children, you know, the boys were working boys. That really hadn't been in, I hadn't ever really thought of these children before or their families. Reading, Pennsylvania is known as one of the most thriving industrial cities in the late 19th and, you know, probably most of the first half of the 20th century. And I just went into this project thinking that we were going to bring these invisible people into visibility and let them, you know, bring them back into Reading's story.
Right.
But then, you know, the first time I realized it was, and I explain in the article, that I was leaning over a student's essay, trying to remember what, she was writing about a specific person. I believe his name was Paul. And I read, she's an African-American student, and I was reading her paragraph on minstrel shows, and this man, Paul, who she was praising, you know, he's so great. He's what a great actor. He's such a great singer, because that's what she had been documenting.
Right. Yeah.
And really had no idea what a minstrel show was, even though, and then I, you know, as I opened the discussion with other students, I realized that many students had come across it and they were just drafting. So I hadn't seen the drafts yet. You know, there were so many topics. So there were topics like the Mothers Club. There was an early auxiliary club of mothers. And the students who, or the student or students who were writing about that were, that was one of their big things. They put on these minstrel shows.
Right, right.
And then I realized that the students, for the most part, had no idea what minstrel shows were. They knew what blackface is, but they didn't know its history.
Yeah. So part of what's fascinating about this as an example in your work with students is that you're really giving them an experience of research, of what happens when you are imagining that you're going to find one set of things. You're looking for one set of you know, kind of thoughts, positions, you know, ideas, and then you stumble across this other really complex, difficult material. I can imagine that this has probably transformed how you approach students with research as a topic in some ways.
Yes, I mean, you know, one of the things about these community writing partnerships is you just don't have a lot of control, especially with history and public memory. Because you can't control what they're going to find when they start looking.
Right, right.
And this was really a challenge because it was obviously was and is a terribly sensitive issue. And for me, you know, there was a real personal connection to the Olivet. I had begun volunteering there. I guess at that point I had been a volunteer for about a year, and now I'm in the same building with a lot of the same children, but a lot of turnover for 4 years. And I know well, and you know, I just, my heart broke really because there are African American children there. And I guess this was the other dimension that I hadn't mentioned, that I didn't mention yet, because there's so much that went on, but Reading right now, well, was named in 2011 the poorest city in the United States with population of 65,000 or above. And it's a very, it has a high Latino population. And I'd been doing some, like one of the things that started to strike me when I was doing the original research before the students started, was seeing these children and learning a little bit about who they were and who their families were, and realizing that, you know, there was this poverty. Now, poverty, it was different because these were working boys, as the Mr. McCormick called them. And so he, like the way he described these boys was that, you know, they were working all day and then they had a little bit of money so that they'd go out and hang out on the street corner or the pool room and drink and get in trouble unless they had a place to go. But then I also started reading about the urban boy reform movement, and what really struck me was, you know, it was 115 years later, I guess 117 years later. And, you know, here's this organization that is there to protect children, you know, from various different circumstances. And now the faces are mostly Latino and African American, and before the faces were white. And the other thing that goes on in Reading, especially once we had national media being named the poorest city in the country, and there's a lot of Latino blaming. And then I started reading one article by, I remember the last names, Cope and Latcham, and it wasn't in our discipline, they were writing about Buffalo and what they called Latino narratives of decline, and how this post-industrial poor city was also Latino blaming.
It's fascinating. Jens, what do you think?
Lori, I wanted to ask you just about the composition of the article, because I was really struck, obviously, by the photographs that are there. I mean, the article starts with this really wonderful photograph, but then also some of the textual documents that you show us in the article. Really appreciated that. But then also particularly the excerpts that you bring in from student writing, but then also from some of the community stakeholders, I believe it's the people who kind of run the Olivet organization. You kind of share their writing and their responses and their communications, right, with you and the students about how to kind of handle the topic of the minstrel shows. And so I'm wondering about, just for you as a writer drafting this article, how did you approach that and kind of weaving all these things together? Were there any concerns for you about kind of trying to represent all sides in this kind of complex, community partnership, and just anything that you found as you kind of, again, literally put this article together, any insights or thoughts about that?
So, you know, with the student writing, there were basically three students involved, and, you know, I obviously had their permission. I talked about it with them. Now, they were in very different positions in a way, because the two students that wrote the original or the article on African Americans and Olivet, or African Americans in Olivet's history, their names were Stephen and Brad, and they had a very intensive experience I'll just never forget when they came upon this article about, I think it was in the Adirondacks, where it was a research article that basically said that, and this, I can't remember, sorry, my memory just isn't good enough, but it was something like in the 70s or 80s or 90s, there were still these minstrel shows in this Adirondacks town, and the writer was insisting that they weren't racist, and not because they weren't intentionally racist, but that they weren't racist because nobody in the town thought of them that way. Or they would say that it brought their community together in fun and revelry, and not that it brought up, you know, stereotypes or perpetuated stereotypes or discrimination or racism. And so I had very intense conversations with them about then and now, and you know, that whole issue of, well, if it was acceptable then, do we judge them now, and how do we judge them? Kimberly was a junior or senior that year. She's now in her second or third year of law school. And so she was working as like an editorial assistant for this project. And she was tasked with, I tasked her because she was also writing, she was doing independent research with me about her role, because she had done an oral history in another professor's class of someone, of a man who just really, really upset her about what he was saying about gender and when they decided to allow girls into the boys' clubs officially in 1990. But anyway, so my conversations with her were really sophisticated. She rewrote the essay that the young men had written to de-emphasize the minstrel part. Mm. She really thought she did it. Mm. And the community partners rejected it anyway. Mm-hmm. Getting back to your question, I was definitely concerned more about quoting what, you know, these two men who were my Olivet partners, and what they would say, you know, what they said. And, you know, I just think that's kind of the, when I thought about doing this podcast, I thought, you know, still at this moment, I can't explain half of this. Mm. I just can't. You know, on the one hand, we were all stunned because this is an egalitarian organization. This is a social justice organization. I mean, I love this organization. It's not perfect. And, you know, I know that some people consider it to be more a perpetuate the inequity rather than, you know, overcome the inequity type of organization, that it keeps the system in place because it's not really political. Yeah. And yet I've spent 4 years there, and I know that these children need it. So I've lost my train of thought, I think, but
We hear it.
It's just so hard to reconcile.
And yet worth doing, worth attempting, worth exposing students to these issues, worth thinking about history, public memory, archival research, community partner, and partnering with people in the community to do this work. It's good.
Yeah, I mean, I love it. Yeah. And I keep doing it.
Right. We've been talking with Laurie Groman, whose essay, Disturbing Public Memory in Community Writing Partnerships, it appears in the September 2017 CCC. Laurie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.